about that, everybody. I was thinking we were going to try and have an early night and get away a bit quick, but I'll still try and do that for you anyway. Did that work? Oh, yeah, boom. Everyone give it up for Sam. So thanks for being late, Sam, so I couldn't test the equipment. Thanks, Sam. Yeah. All right, so tonight we're doing the third king of Judah, so you're right, you got it right. It was Rehoboam, Solomon's son, and then we're jumping over Abijah, but we'll mention him briefly in a moment, and then we're coming to look at Asa tonight. So what the Bible does for us is gives us three, essentially, scenes in his life. Okay, he lives a whole, true, long, full, proper life, but the Bible only gives us a window, or you get three scenes, and that's the way we're going to break it down tonight. We're going to do the three scenes, then we're going to take four lessons from each of the scenes, the way we're going to do it, so you can like this. You'll know when how close we are to going home, so I'm telling you. We're going to do two lessons from scene one. We're going to do a lesson from scene two and a lesson from scene three, and I'm mindful of the time. Okay, that makes sense? That makes sense? Okay. Are you talking? Okay. All right, and each scene, we're just going to do a bit of reading. So because we're doing two lessons here, we're going to break scene one into two readings. I'd like you to give up for Luke. Oh, first, wait. I'd like you to look up 2 Chronicles 14. And then you can have like this surround sound thing where your eyes can follow the words and then your ears can listen to Luke read 2 Chronicles 14, verses 1 to 8. Go.
All right, 2 Chronicles 14. So Abijah slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David, and Asa his son reigned in his stead. In his days the land was quiet 10 years. And Asa did that which was good and right in the eyes of the Lord his God. So he took away the altars of the strange gods and the high places, and brake down the images, and cut down the groves, and commanded Judah to seek the Lord God of their fathers, and to do the law and the commandment. And he took away out of all the cities of Judah the high places and the images, and the kingdom was quiet before him. And he built fenced cities in Judah, for the land had rest, and he had no war in those years, because the Lord had given him rest. Therefore he said unto Judah, let us build these cities, and make about them walls, and towers, gates, and bars, while the land is yet before us, because we have sought the Lord our God, we have sought him, and he hath given us rest on every side. So they built and prospered. And Asa had an army of men that bare targets and spears, out of Judah 300,000, and out of Benjamin that bare shields and drew bows 280,000. All these were mighty men of valor.
Awesome. How good was Luke? Show him some love. All right. Okay, that's enough. Okay, we're up to scene one, okay? And remember, in scene one, we're going to do two lessons. So scene one, we're sort of introduced to Asa's father. His father is Abijah. That's the one we've skipped between Rehoboam and Asa, and it's Abijah. Now, Abijah, he's a busy dude. He's got 14 wives and 22 sons and 16 daughters. Probably the daughters kept him busiest, but anyway. But interesting, of the 38 children, Asa becomes the king. And he becomes king after 17 years of Rehoboam's reign and then 3 years of his dad Abijah's reign. And they're all reigns of lawlessness and godlessness and idolatry. So that's his kind of 20-year previous history. Lawlessness, godlessness, idolatry. And it says of Abijah, we heard it there in verse 3, he committed all the sins his father had done before him. And just tune into what the Bible's suggesting about him. He's saying his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, and then it compares that to something else. So his heart's not devoted. It compares that to the heart of David, as the heart of David, his forefather, had been fully devoted to God. So the test of Abijah and equally the test of David is what's going on with the heart's devotion to God. And so what follows as a result in Asa's life is 41 years. We have 20 years of godlessness. We've got 41 years of a predominantly positive reign of Asa that follows. So, scene one, lesson one. Now, I don't know who in this room this is applicable to what's going on in Asa's life, but I suspect it may be specifically applicable to one or two of you. And the lesson is pretty simple, really. It is, you're not a spiritual victim of your spiritual circumstances. Now, perhaps there's someone in here whose spiritual environment is not ideal. I don't know what's going on in all of your lives. Hopefully your dad doesn't have 14 wives and you've got 37 brothers or sisters. Hopefully it's not that dire. But I don't know. I don't know what's going on in your life. And perhaps for you it's a daily struggle to live in your environment, to maybe to not be enticed by it, to not be drawn into it, into the expectation of just you're going to become a part of it. You're going to follow it and live it, almost be trapped by it. Perhaps if you do have a bad environment, perhaps you'll feel, well, it's just inevitable that the poor spiritual state of that environment, might be your parents, might be your family, might be a circle of friends, whatever it might be, perhaps you just think, well, it's inevitable, I'm just going to become like that. It's like involuntary, this predetermined spiritual helpless outcome. Well, if that does apply to you, well then Asa is a fine example of a person who is not a spiritual victim to his spiritual circumstances. 20 years of bad spiritual background is his life. His life has been full of a family of chaos, of sinfulness, of idolatry, of bad hearts in terms of their devotion to God, but it didn't trap Asa. And he breaks that cycle and he reigns for 41 years. And so if you want to break a cycle, Asa's your man. Have a think about him. Make him a mentor for breaking a bad spiritual cycle. And it's really great because he just doesn't break it for himself. He breaks it for his whole nation. And that's inspiring as well. Think about that in your life. You know, maybe you can break a cycle in your life, but that might be more important than you. You might be able to change a whole lot of people around you. Now, others of you, in fact, I imagine most of you, will come from fine spiritual circumstances. You'll have excellent spiritual instruction and guidance will be your background. Perhaps even generations of faithful Christadelphians. But in a way, that circumstance also needs your attention because it's got its own pitfalls as well. It warrants your careful spiritual thinking because there's many other biblical examples where a faithful heritage, a wonderful background is followed by a child who spoils it, who's different to it, who doesn't take it on. Or perhaps, maybe even worse than that, or certainly more insidious than that, is the mistake of thinking that the spiritual background of your family, their history, their status, their service, their discipleship, somehow gives you something, somehow conveys something to you, that you maybe deserve or warrant something unique or some special kind of spiritual consideration. I don't know, your dad might have written a book, your mum might have started an ecclesia, your grandparents might have been the first people to preach in a place now teeming with Christadelphians. Maybe all your friends sit on every study week committee and I don't know, whatever it is. Don't make the mistake of thinking that that necessarily conveys something of spiritual status to you. The first lesson from Asa is you are spiritually responsible for you. There's no blaming his father. He needs to be different. He is spiritually responsible for himself as you are. You need to make the call. You need to man up, woman up, human up, whatever the right thing is to say these days. And, you know, you live with remarkable opportunities to do that. Of all periods in history, you are extremely healthy. You're going to live for a long time if something tragic doesn't happen. You're extremely wealthy, wealthiest bunch of people of all time. You've got abilities and skills like no one else in all of history. You can just read and write. That's an amazing thing. As I came in, people were talking tonight about a debate they had at school today. That's an amazing gift and skill that you've all got. You can analyse something. You can weigh up stuff. You've got this kind of education and ability that's beyond anything that's happened to many people your age over history. And, of course, you've got access to such wisdom. There's people around you like Uncle Rick up the back. He's very wise, aren't you, Rick? Ish. Wise-ish. But you do. You've got all sorts of people you can tap into. And if you don't tap into people, like in your ecclesia, you've got books and you've got the World Wide Web and all those kind of things. You've got access to wisdom. And I guess there might be someone sitting here saying, oh, yeah, but you don't know how bad I've got it. You don't know the challenges that I have. And it seems tough for me to make these calls at the moment. Well, all I can say is that I'm very sorry if you've got a challenge. There's many challenges in life. Some of you may be dealing with loss, with grief. Some of you might have real mental health issues and challenges you're dealing with. Maybe you're going with friends or a really bad support network. I don't know what your issues are. But even those, as awful as they are, as real as they are, well, they're no barrier to just choosing God. That's a crutch that I don't think you've got. Asa's the example. He's your man to break a cycle. He started a revolution in his life, and it's certainly an opportunity for you as well. So that's the first lesson. Back to the story then. Asa, okay, remarkably, breaks the cycle, and he deals with idolatry and commands Judah to seek God, so he gets the whole nation on board to keep the law and the commandments. He does pretty cool things. He builds fortified cities. He's got a mega army. He's got 300,000 people from Judah and 280,000 people from Benjamin. They're called mighty men of valour. And then Judah, as Luke read there towards the end, has peace. So there's this massive reform, blessed by God with a peaceful result. And he broke a cycle. All right, still in scene one, lesson two, but we're going to read. So everyone stay in 2 Chronicles 14. Is that where we were? Yep. Austin is going to read verses 9 through to 15, please. Awesome. Thanks, Austin. Give Austin some love as well. I think Luke got more love, Austin. Oh, no. Jeez. Tough. All right, so we're still in scene one. Ethiopia invades Judah and they're no lightweights. How many men turned up from Ethiopia? Just a few, just a million. Ethiopia's forces are vastly superior to Asa's. Like, we thought he had something going on. He had 580,000 and then Ethiopia rocks his world with a million. Not only that, but they're not only superior in numbers, they're superior in weaponry. They've got chariots, he's got foot soldiers. And the thing that I just want to focus on is that beautiful prayer in verse 11. O Lord, there is none like you to help between the mighty and the weak. Help us, O Lord our God, for we rely on you, and in your name we have come against this multitude. O Lord, you are our God, let not man prevail against you. And the victory is granted to Asa, as we know, from God and he gets all that plunder and spoils as a result. So the lesson, so we're still seeing one, now lesson two. And it's really the elements of the prayer that I just want you to just sort of see. There's kind of two really important elements in this prayer. Very simple things. The first thing is he confesses his helplessness. So he says to God, I am weak. I need your help. So it's a confession of helplessness. The second thing is he then says, I have faith in you, God, that you can lead us to victory. He says, there is none like you. I rely on you. Now, I don't know how to actually teach you this fundamental lesson from this prayer. This is important, what's going on here. I don't know how to kind of make it cut through and stick in your heart or mind or whatever it is. I don't know how to land it. I've just got to try and point it out. Hopefully someone hears it, because this is a really critical thing for salvation, and it's not rocket science. And the lesson is to develop a proper sense of self, and in turn, a proper sense of who God is. You know, my heart, I don't want to think as though I'm having a crack at you guys, my heart is just like your heart. It's hardwired to an improper sense of self. It's hardwired to self-importance and self-reliance. It's hardwired to deceive me, and yours is hardwired to deceive you about the indisputable fact that you, like Asa, need help and you're weak. Asa got it. The question is, will we? Because the problem is that hard wiring is that it can lead you to a place where you forget about the fact that's true about yourself, and that you need God's help, and in so doing, you reach the place where you neglect Him. You neglect the one who can actually resolve the reality of your problem. Asa was not deceived about his sense of self, and so he was able to turn to God and say, I need your help, I'm weak, I've got to rely on you, and I don't know how to change your heart about this. It's hard enough to change my own heart, but I just want to point this out. This thing that runs deep in your psyche and your heart is this ugly, natural bent to self-reliance and self-importance. And that means as you elevate yourself, you distance God. I don't know if you've ever noticed in like the first sin in the Bible that this is actually at the heart of that first sin. You know, Adam and Eve grab the fruit, whatever it is, they break the command. That's the sin. God says, don't eat, but they grab it and eat it. That's the sin. But what's at the heart of that? What's the motive for it? You remember that they were intrigued, inspired, motivated by this idea that they wouldn't die. That's an improper understanding of yourself. And that they believed that this new knowledge that they would get from eating from the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil would make them like God. That's at the heart of it. They had an improper understanding that they thought that they weren't going to die, and that then they elevated themselves because they wanted to be like God. It's a perverse and completely misunderstood view of themselves. And it's at the heart of their sin. And ever since that day, thousands of years ago when they took that fruit and committed that sin, humanity, I'm going to suggest you, have struggled to understand self and to elevate God. And Asa doesn't in that prayer. That's awesome. It's amazing what he does in that prayer. He actually struggles with the thing that you and I struggle with all the time. He's clear-sighted about himself and he's clear-sighted about God. And that's fundamentally important. It's fundamentally important for us all to wrestle with that. I've got to do it every day. I'm not like talking down to you guys or anything. This is a real deal thing. To stop the self-deception and throw myself at the feet of God, to just say what he says. Help me, O Lord my God, for I rely upon you. All right, we're now up to scene two. That's good. Getting closer to going home. And I'm going to ask Daniel, so you're going to turn the page to, maybe it's the same page. We're going to do 2 Chronicles 15. We're going to see whether Daniel does this well, first of all, the reading, because it's a whole chapter I'm going to ask him to read. So he's got to do it with meaning and speed and understanding. Whole chapter. Okay, 2 Chronicles 15, follow along with Daniel. We loving Daniel? I think he took it out. Oh, yeah, he took it out, didn't he? That was good. Yep, okay. All right, so the victorious army returns, right? They've just killed 1 million Ethiopians and taken all their goodies. And there's against that, you know, the odds, against the odds rout. And a prophet Azariah comes up and he takes the opportunity to remind Asa and the entire nation that this success has come from God. And he reminded Asa of his military vulnerability and the crimes of his father and his grandfather, and he compared that to the safety that's going on since the revival that Asa undertook in scene one. And he says, to Asa, you know, I urge you to keep going with this commitment to the Lord. And Asa, he responds. He redoubles his efforts, and the former revival took on new life, and he tours the nation and he destroys idols and he abolishes immoral practices, is that a word? Practices, and he reinstitutes the worship of the Lord, and that effort lasts about 5 years, at which time he calls the entire population of Judah together to Jerusalem, and he does it, he gets more force to his efforts. He draws the people in and he renews their covenant to the Lord. And he sort of says, I'm going to give you capital punishment if you don't, if you maintain your pagan habits, and you've got to follow the law of Moses. And the public's thrilled. They celebrate it intensely. They go, yes, we're in. And as a result of that dedication, as Daniel read at the end, God gave them peace on all borders for another 20 years. So the lesson, there's something fabulous going on here in verses 17 to 19, right towards the end of that reading. And I'm going to come to that lesson by just space jumping right out of Kings and Chronicles and asking you a question. What's the law of the first fruits all about? What happens? What are you supposed to do under the law of the first fruits in the law of Moses? Give them to God. And so and it's kind of pretty obvious in the word, but what are you giving to God? You're giving your first fruits. And is it only fruit? You only give God fruit? Is that what it means? Wine. Yep. Husbandry, everything. Yeah, sheep, everything. That's right. So the first of your crops, the first of your harvest, the first of your flocks are given to God. So just put yourself in the shoes of somebody who's a farmer and just have a think about that as an action. When you're doing that, what are you kind of like giving up? What are you sort of giving to God? What's that process that's happening? So a farmer gives their first lamb. They've been waiting for their all winter for their first bunch of grapes. They've been waiting all winter for the first crop of olives. What's going on when you just grab any one of those things and give it to God? What are you giving away?
Sort of like the adage of one hand. So you're giving away the one bird in the hand, trying to get two in the bush, because God is saying, if you give me this one bird, I'll give you plenty more, but it takes trust.
Another word that's trust, that starts with F. Faith. Excellent. Very good. That is dead right. That's spot on. So you're giving away something that's precious because you don't know whether a second lamb's coming. You don't know whether a second crop of olives are coming, another bunch of grapes are coming. You're giving away something like it's super precious. This is how you survive in life. But you're doing it on the basis that you trust God is going to let another crop come, another animal come. You are expressing, you're giving up something precious, and in doing that, you're expressing faith in God. Here's like the easiest question of the night. Who gives up the first fruits and who receives the first fruits? Who gives them up? Who receives them? Very good. Even Sam got it. That's how easy that one. Okay, so the law of the first fruits, let's be clear about this, isn't about God going, yes, 1,000 baby lambs. Yes, 10 billion olives. Yes, more grapes. The law of the first fruits, God's asking for that because he's trying to teach us stuff. He's trying to establish stuff about our way of life, about our way of thinking. And the way of life, the way of thinking is first God. Not just at the time of harvest, but always. To always be thinking and acting first God. When you wake up, first God. When you go about your daily business, first God. When something significant happens in your life, first God. When making decisions, first God. The law is seeking to change hearts and minds, so it seeps into your attitude so that you become a person who first God. Now, do you know the first time? This is rhetorical because I don't think you will, but I'll just Maybe someone will. Maybe I'll be shocked. Do you know the first time the word first fruits is used in the Bible? Yeah, out of time. Okay. It's, in fact, the third word in the English Bible. The third word in the English Bible is? That's the first word. Sam, we had such high hopes for you. In the beginning. Okay, all right, thanks. Good one, Sam. So the third word in the English Bible, beginning, is the word reshit, R-E-S-I-Y-T in Hebrew, and it's translated on many occasions after that, first fruits. And so if we take just the first sentence of the Bible, let's just think about this. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. You can state that same sentence in this way. The heavens and the earth are God's first fruit. Right? That's equal, that statement is true. The heavens and the earth are God's first fruit. So, the first mover of this spiritual idea of first fruits is who? It's God. He's the first mover to provide first fruit, and his first fruit is creation. And here is where the lesson starts to emerge, where this idea becomes rich, because what God is establishing is a call and response thing that's going on here. So in music, we know what a call and response is in music. Anyone? 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 Viola? Anyone? Yeah, Sam knows, but he's too frightened to say. Okay, so we see it in concerts, like the rock star does a call and the audience copies, right? I don't know. Let's try one. Ayo. So embarrassing. So embarrassing. Okay. that makes me feel like a rock star. No, hardly. Let's try another one. Some people can't even get it in order. Let's try it again. Oh, that's nice. Hopeless. Oh, yeah, okay, all right. I feel like a rock star. No, I don't. I feel stupid. Sorry, I'm embarrassed. Gone red. Sweating it up here. Okay, so let's just get back to the Bible. So there's a call and response thing going on here. God's first fruit is creation, and it's a majestic insight into who God is. It's actually what he's like. God undertakes a creation. He creates a place, a beautiful place, and he inhabits it. He puts animals into it and grows vegetation and makes it abundant and beautiful. And he takes humans and he forms them and he puts them there. And he creates that. That's his first move. It's his first fruit is that. It's a call. That's what God's doing. He provides the first fruit as a call. And the law says, respond. Be like that. Be like God. Manifest that characteristic. In gratitude, respond. That's his call. In gratitude, respond. In thankfulness, respond to that. In praise, respond. Develop a character and an attitude that says, first God, I want to give you my best. I want to give you my first fruits. I want to give you my life. I want to put you first and at the beginning of everything in a response because you called. And so there's a pattern of call and response in this idea of first fruits. But there's a really, really extra cool thing because you think call, response, the end. No. God says this to Israel in Deuteronomy 28. Don't need to look it up. He says this. If you keep my commandments, if you respond, I've called and I've asked you to respond. If you do that, then the Lord will make you abound in prosperity in the fruit of your womb, in the fruit of your livestock, in the fruit of your ground, within the land that the Lord swore to your fathers to give you. So did you see that? God calls. We respond. Is that the end? No. He says, I'll respond again to your response. I'll give you fruit, fruit, fruit. So there's an amazing idea sitting in that. God calls. We respond. even God responds to our response. And of course, if the pattern keeps going, we should respond to that as well. There's a cyclical pattern here that is that God is responsive to our dedication to him, and we respond to that again and again. There's a call and response pattern in the idea of the first fruits. So what on earth has that got to do with Asa and 2 Chronicles 15? Well, what on earth has that got to do with it? Well, we just saw it in action. We're going to get to see God again. We get to know God again, to see his personality, and it's fabulous. Let's just think about the call-response pattern. Azariah turns up and he provides God's call. On behalf of God, he calls to Asa. He says, "The Lord's with you. The Lord will be found by you. Take courage. Don't let your hands be weak. You will be rewarded." God calls to Asa. And we read that Asa responds. Verse 8, "As soon as he heard these words, got rid of idols, repaired the altar, united the tribes, great sacrifice and dedication, gets the people to join in, and they renew their covenant to seek the Lord, they swear an oath, he removes his grandmother from being the queen." He responds to the call, and if the call and the response pattern is correct, well, we should see God respond in turn to that. He's promised he would in Deuteronomy. Let's not put God to the test, but let's see if it comes true. And it says there in verses 18 to 19, "Nevertheless, the heart of Asa was wholly true all his days, and he brought into the house of God the sacred gifts of the Father and his own sacred gifts, silver and gold and vessels." Did God respond to all of the stuff that we read about in 2 Chronicles 15? "And there was no more war until the 35th year of the reign of Asa." There it is. He responds. He calls. Asa responds. And God in turn says, I'm going to give you peace for 20 years, Asa, and all of Judah. And that's what God's like. That's who he is. He's called you. Let's think about it. He has called you. We have a pattern here that's a spiritual idea to have a think about. Are you going to respond to that? And if you do, well, he said, "Well, I'm faithful. I'll respond to you as well. I'll be with you." And of course, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to have this kind of easy, breezy, cruisy life, trouble-free. That's not what the call and response pattern's about. But what you will have is the surety and the certainty and the faithfulness of God himself. He'll be with you. He'll care for your eternal well-being. God will be calling and responding, and you will be responding to him. He'll be with you in your life. Not much better than that. Righto, scene 3. Just about there. Okay, I'm just going to tell you what scene 3 is. We won't read it. And this map's helpful. So we now just jump a whole many years. We now we've looked at scene 1 of his life, scene 2 of his life, and now there's a big space, and we come to much later in Asa's life. And King Baasha of neighbouring Israel, King Baasha's from Israel, so this is quite helpful, this map, because you can kind of see that there's a bit of a geopolitical thing that we're going to read about. It's a bit like what we're seeing at the moment in places like Russia and the Ukraine. There's actually a bit of a thing happening here. And so King Baasha of Israel, he begins to prepare for war with Judah. And what he does is he closes the border and starts fortifying cities here. Now you can see immediately that's a problem for Judah. Judah is relied upon trade routes, and you can see just how isolated what the country becomes as soon as you start blocking this part of the nation. These trade routes all of a sudden become a problem. And look how close Jerusalem is. Like, this guy's starting to build up war through here, the nation's here, and starts to choke the nation of supplies, trade, economy, and so on. Now, so naturally, Asa sees this as a threat that he's got to take seriously, particularly when Baasha's preparations are a long, fair way along, and what he does
Asa, who's down here in Jerusalem, he negotiates with this dude, King Ben-Hadad of Aram, or modern-day Syria, King Syria, King Ben-Hadad. Now, he is currently, these guys are currently at peace, but historically they've been enemies. And the way he goes about persuading him is he actually ransacks the temple and takes cash out of the temple and goes and pays this guy, King Ben-Hadad, to start causing war here. So he makes a deal with that guy. He relies upon wealth taken out of the temple to convince this guy to attack here. As he attacks here, naturally, these fortifications and the like don't no longer become a bit of an interest. The king of Israel starts to defend himself, and while he moves away from these fortifications, Asa is able to come in and go, sort it all out, unpack the problem, get rid of the fortifications, and essentially stop the threat of Israel coming to beat him up. So King Baasha of Israel never rejoins the project. Now in 2 Chronicles 16, how do you think God and the prophets feel about what's going on here? It says this, as I'll paraphrase, the Lord sent the prophet Hananiah to tell Asa that he'd been negligent. God had intended to bring disaster on Ben-Hadad, who was always hostile to Israel and Judah, but Asa had failed to consult God in this crisis. There's a geopolitical crisis going on here, and the first thing he does is not first God. He does not consult God, and Hananiah reminds him that he'd faced a great crisis before. A million Ethiopians. This wasn't like a problem he hadn't dealt with before in his own life. And when he'd done that, he'd called on God, and God had rescued him. But the prophet says that this time you've ignored God, and because of this, the rest of your reign will be marked by war. You think Asa fell on his knees in humility and said, sorry, please forgive me. Unfortunately, he doesn't. This is not a happy ending when it comes to Asa. And he's actually furious about this, and he grabs the prophet and he arrests him, and then he abuses the prophet's sympathisers, and he throws him in jail. And a few years later, King Asa contracts a serious disease in his feet. And once again, it says pretty clearly at the end of 2 Chronicles 16, he didn't seek God. He went and sought doctors instead of God, and they were powerless, and he dies of this disease of the feet. It's a warning to anyone with tinea. So that's what's going on at the end of Asa's life. It's a bit of a letdown, isn't it? And it says there in verses 12 to 13, the 39th year of his reign, Asa was diseased in his feet and his disease became severe. Yet even in his disease, he did not seek the Lord but sought help from physicians. And Asa slept with his fathers, dying in the 41st year of his reign. All right. So there's kind of an obvious lesson. So we're now scenes 1, 2 and 3 done. We're now up to lesson, the final lesson. Home time is very close. 10 past 9, I know. Sorry, I'll be quick. There's an obvious lesson here, and that is if you start strong, don't let it peter out at the end. Right? So that's a pretty obvious kind of lesson. You need to heed that warning in your life. I need to heed the warning in my life to try and stay true all the way through. But I really want to finish by thinking about, well, how do we think about Asa then? Because I think that's a troubling idea, right? He's an amazing individual who seems to blow it at the end. And it's not my place and it's not your place to make any complete determinations on Asa's eternal status or position. That's the realm of God. God can decide whether Asa's in the kingdom or not. But it is our place to try and work out, well, what's the main lesson from this life? It's in the book. It's there for us to read. What are we to kind of understand about him? What's the holistic message for you and I? And I think there's a clear answer, and it lays in a Hebrew phrase.
And the Hebrew phrase is Labab Salem. If you type that in to a search engine, you get heaps of kebab restaurants come up. It's not a bad thing either, but it's probably not a spiritual thing, so I'll move right on from that. So Labab Salem means a true heart, a whole heart, a true heart. And I just want to dance through a few quotes. We're going to finish pretty quickly. I'll dance you through a few quotes where this phrase occurs. So in 1 Kings, this is about Solomon, so about his great-grandfather. Solomon, he says this to the people at the temple dedication. He says, "Let your heart, therefore, be wholly true. I want you to be Labab Salem," he says, "to the Lord our God, walking in his statutes and keep his commandments as at this day." Now, in 1 Kings 11, a few chapters later, unfortunately, it says this about Solomon. "For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not, he was not Labab Salem. He was not wholly true. He didn't have a true heart to the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father." 1 Kings 15 says about Asa's father, so we're starting to get a bit closer now in terms of timeline, says of his father, "And he walked in all the sins that his father, Rehoboam, did before him, and he was not Labab Salem." He did not have a true heart to the Lord his God as the heart of David, his father. Now, so I have a think about what happens when you pick up the Bible. The Bible's a written book, right? Someone's written it. The author of the Bible gets to write about Asa in hindsight. It's not writing it at the time. He's writing it after the period, and he gets to write in hindsight. So although we read it in a chronological fashion, we read it as a narrative, the author writes after the event, and it's not unusual in the Bible to get a holistic insight into a character when we're first introduced to them. I want to tell you about Daniel. He won the reading competition of the Friday night. That's probably not a holistic comment. No, I want to tell you about Daniel. He's a top bloke. And then you can go on to talk about something about breaking down individual actions. But in representing Daniel, I've made a statement at the beginning in my commentary that he's a top bloke. Well, that happens often in the Bible. The author will give us a hint early on, a summary statement that sums up the person. And here is the way the author presents Asa when we're first introduced to him. 1 Kings 15, verses 9 to 11. "In the 20th year of Jeroboam, king of Israel, Asa began to reign over Judah, and he reigned 41 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Maachah, the daughter of Abshalom, and Asa did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, as David his father had done." 2 Chronicles 14. "Abijah slept with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David, and Asa his son reigned in his place. In his days the land had rest for 10 years, and Asa did what was good and right in the eyes of the Lord his God." 1 Kings 15. "Nevertheless, Asa was Labab Salem to the Lord all his days." So I hope you haven't been to too many funerals. They're actually a pretty difficult thing, funerals. But what I think is particularly awful about a funeral is there's, you've heard of the thing called the eulogy, right? There's that 10, 15, 20, 30 minute talk that you give about someone. Now, a eulogy is an extremely cruel task because there's a 20 minute talk about a dead person. And there's something so cruel and incomplete and unsatisfying and almost wrong about taking a whole life lived, and summarising it in 20 minutes. A life that's full of relationships, of laughter, of achievements, maybe having children, maybe it's a life that impacted people, maybe it was a faithful life. A life of seeing sunsets, seeing sunrises, a life of, I don't know, walking with bare feet on mown grass, of swimming in the sea, of planting a tree that's now grown and is beautiful, tall, bears fruit, building a house maybe, fixing an ecclesial hall, making a piece of art, being an inspiration to another person, being someone's most special person, in changing lives in so many, many things, to compress that whole life into 20 minutes, well, that's just, it's cruel, I think. It's a horrible thing. I dread the thought. I often think about it. I dread the thought of trying to write a eulogy for my parents. Like, it's just, it's a horrible thing to think about. What's even harder than that, of course, is to then take all that, it's hard enough to do it in 20 minutes, and then to try and capture a little sentence that you might put on a gravestone. 7 or 8 words. That's pretty hard. Take a whole life and condense it to a sentence. And in many ways, the Bible has the same challenge. Just what is it it's going to take from a whole life and say about that person? What short summary statement could suffice? Well, for Asa, we've actually got two things. 2 Chronicles says it this way. It says, "And Asa did what was good and right in the eyes of the Lord his God." And 1 Kings says it this way. "Nevertheless, the heart of Asa was wholly true to the Lord all his days." Asa, Lebab Salem, to the Lord all his days. And so there it is. That's the life of Asa. To take it or to leave it if you dare. To learn from it or to reject it if you dare. Asa did good before God with Lebab Salem. That's 8 words. That's the graveyard comment. He did good. If you merge those two quotes, he did good before God with Lebab Salem. So I'm going to close now and encourage you to think about the four lessons over the three scenes. Here are the four lessons to remind you. Make your own spiritual way. You're not a spiritual victim to your spiritual circumstances that you find yourself in. Decide, choose, act, self-determine your own spiritual outcome. Second one, rely upon God. Don't trust in yourself. Be self-aware. Be God-aware. Have perspective. Three, engage with God in a pattern of call and response. He's called. He's called. He's called. Respond to him. Give your best. Develop that attitude of God first, and he will respond in turn to your response. Number four, Lebab Salem. Start working on it. Start working on your heart, a true heart. Don't wait for someone to put it on your gravestone. Get on with it now. Make it your mantra today. It's an easy one. Be good, do good with God, with Lebab Salem. Do this, and your own time of peace is coming. And perhaps you'll get to spend some of that in conversation with Asa himself. Thanks.